Welcome to the Geeks of the Valley podcast, your gateway to insightful conversations with the brightest minds shaping today's industries on a global scale. Join us as we delve into the hottest upcoming trends and explore how their work is influencing the global economy. Our podcast focuses on four distinct industry sectors, bringing you discussions from the forefront of venture capital and private equity, innovative minds, entrepreneurship, and policy and multilaterals. What initially began as a casual coffee chat has now evolved into a thriving global platform for visionaries, where ideas are shared and connections are made. We genuinely value your input and eagerly await your suggestions for future guests. If there's a particular individual you're eager to hear from, don't hesitate to reach out to us at geeks@geeksofthevalley.com. Tune in and join us on this exciting journey of knowledge, inspiration, and innovation. Today, we have the privilege of talking to Eddie Chan, a founding partner of Intuito Ventures, an independent venture capital firm exclusively focused on investing in Indonesia. With over $300 million in committed capital, Intuito Ventures serves as the Indonesia beachhead strategy for renowned institutions, including top-tier investors from the Forbes Midas list and family offices worldwide. They also collaborate with more than 35 hyperlocal Indonesian conglomerates and families, making them a unique player in the Indonesian venture capital landscape. Before co-founding Intuito Ventures, Eddie had a remarkable career in venture investments, with notable involvements in startups like PayPal, Palantir, and Affirm since the late 1990s. He also founded and operated venture-backed technology companies in Silicon Valley and Asia, practiced corporate M&A law, and worked as an investment banker. Join us as we delve into Eddie's journey in the world of venture capital, his insights on the Indonesian market, and the fascinating stories behind his experiences with some of the most influential companies in the tech industry. Eddie, thank you so much for joining us this morning. And how are things with you?
Great. Really privileged to be with you and your viewership and reader listeners.
Awesome. Let's jump into the first question here, shall we?
Let's do it.
So Eddie, how does Intuito Ventures differentiate itself as an Indonesia-only venture capital firm?
Yeah, so it's a great question. I would argue that we differentiate by being the only Indonesia-only fund in the world, hence the worst one and the best one. So most folks, as you look at the market, there certainly is Indonesia-focused funds, but they also look at, most of Southeast Asia. So today, we are the only Indonesia-only fund. I would argue, historically, most people took more of a Southeast Asia as a region lens, which we think totally made sense, call it a decade ago, where one could fly to Singapore today, Indonesia the next day, call it Vietnam the next day, and Philippines the next day. But the ecosystem, as it's matured, has really required incremental specialization. And, like it or not, Indonesia does represent, call it 40 to 45% of the population of the entire Southeast Asia of 600 million people. So it represents called 280 million. Out of 600. And if you look at the next three countries combined, of each of Philippines at 105 million, Vietnam at 95 million, and Thailand at call 70 million, you don't hit the same scale from a population perspective. One may argue, though, that you could be, for example, that the following countries are, let's say, richer. But I'd argue that Philippines on a per capita basis is slightly lower, as is Vietnam. Thailand certainly a little bit higher. So ultimately today, Indonesia does represent also about 40% plus of the online GMV or just GDP in general of all of Southeast Asia. So today it's one of not the only country to really build out standalone unicorns. So if you look at the 53 unicorns in Southeast Asia, 15 of them are Indonesian homegrown. But what's most interesting is out of those 15 homegrown unicorns, 13 of them hit unicorn scale before expanding past the borders of Indonesia. So in light of that, today we run the most concentrated strategy with the largest early stage investment team that focuses exclusively on Indonesia, where our team does not fly to Singapore, Thailand, Philippines, et cetera.
And from your perspective, what are the advantages of focusing on a single country and vertical in venture capital investing?
Yeah, so I guess when you think about a single country, I think you got to really focus on strategy either that are, let's say, Singapore out, Israel out, India out, or single country is, focusing on that domestic market. And so Indonesia, as we all know, is, the fourth largest market in the world from a population perspective, on a real GDP today, about 16, but, on track to be, as far as we understand per Goldman Sachs research, the fourth largest market in the world from a real GDP perspective. So focusing on single country, I think, allows us to really hone our team in one country, right? So today we have 10 investment professionals in market, which is the largest early stage investment team. And on top of that, allows us to continue really focused on those relationships in market, where we feel Indonesia is dominated by, call it, 50 to 100 diversified conglomerates, where today we have approximately 40 of those diversified conglomerates as key LPs in our fund. So having all these resources in a single country, you know, whether it be through the pandemic or whatever, we were that, you know, in-country first responder to our portfolio and really indispensable. And as I think on a go-forward basis, I look, you know, the last 5 years, you know, our win rate has been 96% on term sheets we've issued to our, you know, to prospective companies. And I think it's in large part, once again, because that in-country expertise where we can be with our companies day in, day out, be that first responder, support them on commercial distribution with the in-country conglomerates, as well as the online, you know, giants, support them on government and regulatory, where we work very closely with former ministers, United States ambassadors, our investment fund. And then similarly, really supporting these companies also on the talent side. And we support this with a very global strategy, given that we are the only, once again, Indonesia or even Southeast Asian homegrown firm with a presence in Silicon Valley. So on the flip side, we do all those similar things, except bring in top global capital, as well as global human and financial capital into the market. And so that's kind of how we built it out. And I think that every company really appreciates, you know, us, you know, super early stage, delivering a hyper local touch with my partner, Patrick, who's multi-generation Indonesian, been back for 20 years, where he's the former head of Goldman Sachs for private equity and venture, gets me for global. You know, as you guys know, I've been, you know, kind of a venture investor for the last 25 years. Along the way, also a founder and CEO, as well as a corporate M&A lawyer and investment banker, and then gets two associates. So ideally, a company that partners with us will get kind of the best of all worlds in the hyper-local experience, but also a global experience at Series A, where historically you might get a hyper-local experience, but not a global experience, or vice versa, global at growth, but not local experience.
Pushing into this a bit more, how does Intuitive Ventures balance being both hyper-local and global in its investment approach?
Yeah. So I think that as we look at, you know, opportunities, we do, you know, historically, I think early ecosystems certainly are influenced by, you know, call it, you know, Internet 1.0, let's say in Indonesia, had companies like, let's say, Tokopedia in e-commerce, which would be more akin to, let's say, an Alibaba or an Amazon, let's say, in the United States. You had online travel like a Traveloka, which would be more akin to Ctrip in China, or maybe an Expedia in the United States. And then, of course, you had ride hail with, let's say, Gojek, more akin to, let's say, Didi in China or Uber in the United States. And so I think early days, I think that global context is helpful, as for every single unique opportunity that we identify, we often, you know, have relationships with the global counterpart in Silicon Valley or North Asia. And so we bring in those folks as they support on the diligence. And also those folks also provide a lot of valuable guidance once we're into the deal. And then on the flip side, on the local side, we have, you know, best-in-class partners support as well. So I think having both the hyper-local and global lens allows us to consistently win, in that we take the best practices locally and globally. And that's really allowed us to, you know, win on deals and thereafter allow our companies to scale, you know, quite rapidly, taking, you know, global and local best practices. And I think, once again, very privileged that, you know, we are the only firm with, you know, that's homegrown, with a presence in Silicon Valley, where I do spend about, you know, 6 months a year with all our global financial as well as human capital partners.
And given kind of, you know, Indonesia's position geographically, what particularly makes it an attractive market for venture capital investment? And how does Intuitive kind of tap into its potential?
Yeah, so I would say that, you know, on the macro, we, you know, we're very much more of a micro investor, in that we're a bottoms up investor. We're not here to tell you, you know, all the macro stats. If we capture X percent of, you know, the this TAM, then, you know, this company's going to be a unicorn or whatever it may be. But, you know, just to reiterate, you know, for the listeners here, you know, it is the fourth largest market in the world at 280 million population, growing pretty rapidly at consistent 5% GDP year over year growth. I'd like to say this year, amongst the major economies, you know, outside of India, I think it's the fastest growing country, and for the foreseeable future. And once again, on track to be the fourth largest country in the world by real GDP, not PPP, in 2050, probably number five by 2045. And maybe in the next decade, top 10. So I think that the macro factors certainly are encouraging the rising middle class, this demographic dividend where you have, you know, the largest, you know, soon to be the third largest workplace population in the world, when I'm talking about people from 18 to 64 years old. So we think that the demographics are really encouraging. You know, folks are, you know, satisfying water, food, and shelter, now being having some disposable income. And then also we think on the B2B side, which is really our core focus, really going to make incredible opportunity to really digitize a lot of traditional conglomerates, where when we started the firm in 2017, the local stock exchange had a 0% technology weighting. And, you know, a lot of these second, third, fourth generation owners of these family-owned conglomerates had been tasked by their mom, dad, and or uncle with digitizing, you know, their diversified conglomerate. And I think that was kind of a nice to have, if you will, when we started in 2016, 17. But, you know, by the pandemic, not to say that we predicted it, and coming out of it, you know, offline, online's almost become it's a must have. And so I think that these kind of prevailing factors with the demographics, as well as the digitization of old line industry, really presents a very, you know, incredible opportunity to build pretty sizable businesses with a single country where, you know, you're dealing with one language, one family power, one concept of family power structure and regulatory, versus operating in, you know, more of a regional approach where arguably you're not getting the synergies of, you know, having a call center in some remote area in the US. In Southeast Asia, where we operate, I would argue that you need 8 different call centers for each of the languages, 8 different go-to-market teams, you know, 8 different, you know, legal teams, given the different legal construct, as ASEAN, or Association of Southeast Asian Countries, is more of a loosely affiliated group of countries versus something like the EU, where, you know, you have a common, let's say, a passport or currency. So a lot of the synergies you get by being in single country, and I would even argue that Indonesia itself, to call it a homogenous country may be a lie as well, as you have Indonesia one with, call it, 4 or 5 million people at 135,000 GDP, more akin to a New York or San Francisco. You have Indonesia two, which is, call it, 70 million people at, call it, you know, around $6,000-$7,000 GDP, more akin to, let's say, a Thailand. Indonesia three at 100 million people at, call it, 2,000 to 3,000. So maybe more akin to, call it, a Philippines or Vietnam. And then last but not least, you know, 100 million people at, you know, $627 or $708, $800. So unfortunately, still kind of the global poor, but there's a hope that over time we'll, you know, grow into the middle class. So I do think that, you know, single country is hard enough, let alone a multi-country strategy. And it is one of those countries that's pretty blessed, you know, at the equator. So, you know, many things kind of grow naturally. And so that is our rationale, and just blessed with scale.
Kind of diving into, when it comes to your investment thesis, what key factors does Intuitive consider when identifying moats and you know, maybe companies similar to Zendit?
Yeah. So I think that for us, you know, we're not in the business of, you know, getting behind companies or who can raise money faster and lose money faster. I'd call that, you know, capital as a moat. I'm pretty skeptical as to capital as a moat, aside from just mega, you know, multi-billion dollar projects. And then also historically, I think brand moats is an area that I think we're quite skeptical about, unless these are like multi-generation companies, like, call it, Coca-Cola, et cetera, right? So I think the moats that we're generally most excited by, you know, looking back to our personal experience, you know, investing in whether it be Palantir, Affirm, you know, PayPal, et cetera, I think is on the, we think that regulatory moats, I think, play a very, very key role. And you often see that in financial services, healthcare, and education, where, you know, companies in our portfolio, like Zendit, for example, you know, I think they had a pretty opportunity to win as some global players in the payment gateway space that try to enter the market for several years just had not much luck in the way of getting a license. So today, Zendit is, you know, the most valuable fintech in all Southeast Asia, operating at probably 5-6x the scale of the number two player in Indonesia. And similarly, I've gone into the Philippines and won as well. I think another kind of moat that we're very big on is what we call the operational dependency moat. And so this is very much related to B2B businesses, where often it's extremely tough to sell into companies, but, you know, very tough to kind of rip you out once you're in. And certainly we've seen that, you know, with a lot of our companies, where 75% of our companies in our most recent fund three are B2B, where, once again, we do have 40 of the most influential 50 to 100 diversified conglomerates in Indonesia invest in us, as well as many of the online players, where it's not just a top-down sale, but also a bottom-up sale, where we're making sure all stakeholders are on board. And I think that once you're in, provided that we're continue delivering value in the B2B context, that you're there to stay. And last but not least, really excited by finding businesses that have what we call talent moats. And generally, these are businesses that could be one of one businesses. Like let's say in the genetics space, we have Knowledge Genetics, where if you want to work on genetics, unfortunately, I'm afraid we're bad. Knowledge Genetics may be the only game in town. I think if you look in crypto, let's say with Bintu, which is kind of the Coinbase of Indonesia, Southeast Asia, naturally, if you want to work on crypto, once again, it's one of not the only game in town. It's not that you can go work on it at the major unicorns or other players. There's a talent moat, really, can be exhibited both where people join you not for the size of the diamond ring or the salary, but really it's something that they believe, day in, day out. And often we see that in what we call one of one or more niche businesses versus stuff that's a little bit more general in nature.
And Eddie, can you explain, taking a second cut into this, can you explain the concept of non-consensus investing from a pendulum and sectoral basis and how it influences Intuito's investment strategy?
Absolutely. So I think that when I think about non-consensus investing, I think it's about kind of the fear and greed cycles. And we certainly have gone through them, right? And several of them, whether it be leading up the dot-com, boom and bust, certainly a greed cycle, right? Where you had dot-com at the end of any company or website, company name, and instantly the valuation all of a sudden, goes up by 10x or whatever, right? We certainly saw that, then we saw that certainly leading up to 2020, 2021, right? Where things were up and to the right. I think during those moments, 2021, 2022, early days at least, I see a lot of investors that historically don't invest in venture, or just even, that people that have been in the industry forever really overextend themselves from a pricing perspective or volume of deal perspective. And I think that having seen this and gone through, I guess three cycles myself, given that I started investing in the 90s, I think that we did a pretty good job in Intuito Ventures over the course of the last few years, where I'd argue in 2021, we probably did the least deals or tied for the least deals in the world for venture capital funds, and that we did one new deal in 2021, where many of my peers in Indonesia, Southeast Asia were doing 30, 40, if not 50 deals that year, new ones. And then in 2022, I think that we remained very disciplined on the tail end in the second half of the year when the market kind of had hit kind of a base. I think in aggregate, we did about six new deals, where my peers did maybe even more, called 30, 40, or 50 deals again that year. Now, only in 2023 did I see a lot of folks pull back pretty dramatically. Last year, we did three net new deals. I think some of my peer set did around 10. So what I'm getting at is, ideally, I think to give the LPs the right diversification, I think we try to aim to be pretty consistent across, multiple vintages. So for example, of course it's very tough to catch, invest all at the base and then invest and then exit all at the top, or invest all at the top and or vice versa. But I think our methodology has allowed us to be pretty disciplined and allow LPs to get the benefits of a pretty even keel approach across multiple vintages or years of funds. And so that would be my feedback in terms of non-consensus investing versus being against the grain and fear and greed cycles. And truth be told, I wish I could say the same. I did the same with my personal portfolio, but that's another question. Now, in terms of non-consensus investing, in terms of from a sectoral perspective or from a trend perspective, we would argue that, early days, generally, at early stage, the trend generally is not your friend. When you see 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 companies doing the same thing, where every VC in Southeast Asia has a play, I think generally that's a time that you should get, quite nervous, if you will. Sometimes, as an investor, it's a little bit more difficult to tease out what we call the fake founders, or what it may be that are they doing it because that there's really strong founder market fit, or is that something that they just read about in the newspaper, or the other VCs are publishing white papers on, this great market opportunity. And I had a personal experience in the past starting a business in, a little bit more of a on-trend space like IoT. So we've certainly seen in the last couple of years, certain companies that operate, let's say, quick commerce or in, let's say, SME enablement, which ended up being very bloody sectors, if you will, in Indonesia, Southeast Asia, with a lot of competition. So tough to tease out the fake founders. I think that the entry price on valuation is quite high as many people compete. Not to say that matters that much at Series A, but certainly, and once these companies do raise a Series A, it's very difficult for them to stand out. So often they have to kind of subsidize to win customers. So that's generally not good. Once again, as a VC, right? You don't want to be investing in a burn-driven business. And also, paying up just to win talent, right? Because, you know, a lot of the talent that's graduating from schools, whatever it may be, if they read in the newspaper or, you know, their parents tell them, hey, you should go work in the sector because it's the flavor of the month. So getting back to, you know, on-trend sectors, just generally speaking, you know, you're looking at higher customer acquisition costs, higher employee OPEX, difficulty in teasing out the fake founders, and, higher entry price. These are all, you know, no's that you really would try to stray away from in the context of venture investing. And we're really looking for, once again, those founders that are taking a little bit more of a different worldview. And so we generally, you know, at Intuito, really try to identify opportunities that are investing in sectors that are maybe out of favor, at that time, where at least we can tease out the founders knowing that they're either have a very unique worldview or there's, you know, maybe insane in a bad way. And then on the B, I'm really looking for, you know, opportunities maybe that could be too early for their time, that if we can get behind them over time, they build the right momentum. By the time that anyone does want to run a copycat business, the game's already won. And so I would say that would be kind of the way we think about non-consensus investing, both from, a sectoral perspective, but also from a kind of fear and greed cycle approach.
Taking a turn in the conversation towards LP management, could you elaborate on Intuito Ventures' role in building funds that work alongside generational transfer?
Yes. So I think that LP management plays a large part in our organization. For folks outside of Indonesia or global LPs, 70% of our capital comes from outside of Indonesia, much of which is the United States, which is our large source of capital. So on the US side, it's really working with, a lot of, whether it be top institutions, top funds. We have over a dozen folks on Midas list or Forbes Midas list of the top 100 investors invest in us as well, where we really act as that beachhead strategy where Intuito Ventures takes the early stage risk. We write, single tickets of anywhere from 1 to 30 million US per round. And then on the back end, it's a lot of these top global investors that really, lean in on, the knowledge that we've, developed and the viewpoint we've developed with respect to a certain company or sector, where we're coming in and saying, hey, look, this is an extremely exhaustive memo that provides what is the base case, bear case, bull case? What are the risk factors with this business? And what are the key moats in place? And why you should get behind this business? And we really act as that call beachhead strategy or beachhead partner for, a lot of these LP base globally, whether it be from Silicon Valley, whether it be from North Asia, whether it be from Europe, Middle East, et cetera. And so that's kind of how we play for the global folks. Now for in-country folks, we really act more as the digital, kind of transformation strategy partner in that, we're identifying technology solutions developed by our portfolio that really can then in turn call it scale a lot of these more traditional conglomerates where, once again, the second, third, fourth generation owner has been tasked with digitizing the family-owned conglomerate, where we're here not to disrupt them, but rather really technology enable them with the solutions developed by our portfolio. And so that's kind of how we work with LPs very intimately. Each different LP, once again, as I described earlier, has their unique reasons, whether it be beachhead strategy or digital transformation. And then in terms of, generational transfer, I think that what we're very proud of is when we built this firm, we wanted to build a firm based on our core values, having worked at, different firms, whether it be funds, whether it be investment banks, whether it be operating companies. We thought that culture was preeminent and founder breakup was the ultimate, risk in any called venture firm, early stage startup, et cetera. So we built our firm name on integrity, sincerity, and appreciation for serendipity in the local Bahasa Indonesian language, that's Integritas Tulus Jodo. And so if you combine the key elements of each of those words, it's Intuito. So our firm name is Intuito. It's not named after, our first names or last names. So really a firm to last, multiple funds, if not generational transfer, no different than you probably read recently when they talk about Sequoia, something that can last, for many generations and obviously generational transfer. So We thought that was very critical. And as you look at our firm today, we're on Intuito Fund 4. And what I'm really most proud of is we built out the largest early stage investment team in the country with zero turnover since inception. And we've been at it, you know, call it for 7 or 8 years already. So really, really proud of that.
And speaking of this beachhead strategy, can you explain how it's employed by Intuito and why proactive LP engagement is crucial in underexposed or less familiar markets?
Yeah, so this market, keep in mind, is a little bit off the beaten path, at least for Silicon Valley, in that there's no direct flight there. And as I like to say, people used to historically say, even you know during the boom, once Silicon Valley or San Francisco had a direct flight to a you know any city in the United States, that venture ecosystem valuation went up, you know, pretty instantly, right? And so Indonesia historically has been a little bit, you know, more challenging to get to, given there's no direct flights, you know, from San Francisco, you know, it's a 20-some hour commitment just to get there, right? And so as a beachhead, we really are the eyes and ears on the ground. And that was even more so during pandemic where you can't even fly in, right? And so that is kind of, when you talk about positioning, is that whether it be the United States, this is a market that, when we started, I think had a very small handful of global investors that deployed in the market. But just in the last 7 or 8 years, the number of direct investments by you know global marquee groups is up by like 7 or 8x, if not more. And so once again, we take the early stage risk. We write $1 to $30 million tickets. And a lot of these global partners, as I mentioned, we do have over 10 Forbes Midas List investors or their firms invest in us, really look to us, and we you know support them on their due diligence and give them comfort to come into the market knowing that we will be with the companies day in, day out, where the global fund can deliver a lot of their global insights. And we compare that with our hyper-local insights. And if you look to the day, I'd like to say 40% of our companies have you know received a follow-on round led by one of our LPs or affiliates. So I'm really, really proud of that. I think that 80% of our companies have received capital from our LPs or their affiliates, which I think is very interesting as well. And our follow-on rate across our first fund was 100%. We define that as the number of companies that raised a subsequent round of financing led by an independent third party. And for our second fund, similarly, it's above 90% or so. And I think that's really a tribute to how we've eliminated commercial risk, as I mentioned earlier, bringing a lot of our companies to a lot of these conglomerates to understand, is there actual product market fit? And then B, solving on the finance side where we work intimately with our companies when they go back to market to these, call it 35 or 40 or so global funds or founding partners that are invested in our fund.
And earlier in the call, you alluded to Intuito's internal firm culture. If I may ask, what steps does Intuito take to create this strong internal firm culture, and how does it kind of contribute to serving LPs and founders?
Yes. So yeah, we really, really, we felt very strongly about this. Once again, you know, my co-founder and myself, you know, prior to launching Intuito, we both had, you know, been working for 20, you know, more than two decades across multiple industries. And I think the common thread looking back to as we analyze venture capital funds and startups is that, if the team's not right, it's almost impossible to accomplish anything, right? You know, the right team, wrong market, probably can, you know, pivot, go to another market. Wrong team, right market. Maybe if you're lucky, you'll do okay, but it's only a matter of time before things fall apart, right? And so for us, we thought that team culture was the most important thing. One bad apple can destroy the whole organization, right? And so from the beginning, we were looking for people really that, you know, table stakes was integrity, sincerity, with an appreciation for serendipity. But on top of that, really looking for people that are, you know, hungry, you know, but humble. So I think that you know, I think hungry and ready to be humbled, as, you know, you're going to go in, if we operate in this industry or in the venture industry, you know, you're going to be testing your knowledge in going down the path, you know, untraveled, if you will. And people that are hungry, but never to the you know, detriment of others. And last but not least, really looking for, you know, team members that are really comfortable, you know, getting behind businesses that, you know, are a little bit, you know, out of favor from a sectoral perspective or truly for their time. So really comfortable getting behind, you know, founders that take a dramatically different worldview. And so we are very rigid as we, you know, approach and bring on talent. And we run, historically, we've never used, any HR services for bringing any new members to our team. We've had, required for the most part that every single person that we bring on is interviewed by everyone on the team, so that we have, collective buy-in, which I think has kind of helped remain our company culture today. You know, we have a team of, me, my two co-founders, so three. We now have 9 investment professionals outside of ourselves. So we have 12 investment professionals, and yeah, no one's ever left. And I think that really serves well in the eyes of LPs for continuity, right? Obviously at the partner level, but when they see that every single person on our team is on stage at the annual meeting speaking, they understand that this is a firm that's is going to grow out of the founders, right? And over time, there'll be a second, third generation leaders is our dream, if you will. And then the context of founders, I think that they really appreciate getting, Patrick for hyperlocal, my co-founder, me for global at the board level, as well as support of 2 associates. And that continuity, I think, is very important as well. That initial analyst, associate, manager, or principal that you meet is not like a rotating door. Like in Southeast Asia, most venture capital firms are churning their early stage talent or their investment team at a third to two thirds a year, right? I think this continuity allows us to consistently win. As a founder that partnered with us 6 or 7 years ago, has confidence that six, seven years later, he's working with the same associates that now in turn maybe have been, promoted all the way to principal. And if not, hopefully in the next couple of years, general partner.
Eddie, for people out there who are interested in catching a cup of coffee with you or connecting for a conversation, what would be the best point of contact?
Yeah, I would say that the easiest is probably adding me on LinkedIn. But of course, adding a note, perhaps something along the line saying, hey, look, I heard about you. I listened to your piece on Geeks of the Valley and providing some context. I also feel that any effort on behalf of anyone that wants to reach out, if they're willing to share a little bit about where they learned about us, what they'd like to discuss, that effort and putting a little bit of homework into it, really, I think it goes very far versus somebody just adding you randomly on LinkedIn, not providing any context and, asking for A, B, C, or D. And I feel it's all, very valuable in folks of all ages. I think back to, I think the most valuable thing I think back and what I would tell, my own kid is that think about what value you can deliver, which is every single person has some unique value, I think, to deliver. And it could be in any context. I think the biggest mistake, I think, is for, younger folks that are earlier in their career to feel that there's not much they could offer or contribute. I mean, in my case, I'm always excited when I meet a college student that says, hey, look, I know a lot of talented folks that want to move to Indonesia and build Indonesia over time. That is massively valued to Intuito Ventures, right? And so I think that reaching out via LinkedIn, adding some context to that invitation, and then from there, yeah, we could take it from there, whether the conversation goes best with myself or with somebody on my team. We're always really excited to see how we can deliver value to folks that are interested in learning more about the Indonesian market.
And Eddie, for our last and final question, any last piece of advice for our listeners out there?
Well, yeah, it depends on what type, the background of each of the listeners, but I would just say in general, the core principles that we try to live by within our organization, I think the table stakes is integrity, sincerity, with an appreciation for serendipity, and that a lot of things happen just by chance, but you got to kind of put yourself out there. I always describe it as, back at least when we were in college 20 some years ago, if you wanted to meet a boyfriend or girlfriend or whatever your flavor, you kind of had to show up to the event. Now I do acknowledge this day and age, maybe you can swipe left or right, but I think that showing up is 90% of the battle. So I think that's one. And then B, I think that I think it's really the stuff I outlined earlier. I think just be hungry, but never to the detriment of others. I think that's a constant mistake, but be show hungry, whether it be in learning about knowledge, delivering value. I think it's also very important to be very humble and be ready to be humbled regardless for the rest of your life. As often I think the people we've found that we respect most are those that are comfortable saying that they really don't know about certain things when you ask a question, because the world's ever changing, and I think that there's a need to appreciate that.
Eddie, it was a pleasure having you on Geeks of the Valley, and thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been a privilege. Thank you so much.
you.